perhaps the most important book in the world. And the reason why is because it deals with the meaning of life. And that is an important question because I believe it comes before any of the other questions that we generally talk about when we talk about life and Jewish philosophy. And I want to explain what I mean. The number one question in my mind is not whether you should be a Jew or Christian or a Muslim, Orthodox or Reform. I think the underlying question is whether you should strive for anything. Do we believe that our lives are supposed to mean something and that we have a responsibility to make them mean something? Most of the world today works with the assumption that somehow we got here, we don't know why, we don't know where, no one thinks it's supposed to matter, and we just eat, drink, and do whatever we can while we're alive, and then we die. And the real tension is whether people should believe in something bigger. What that something bigger is a secondary question. And that first question is really what Sefer Qohelet is about. And I think part of its freshness and uniqueness also is that it's the exact opposite of everything you're used to in Jewish philosophy, and I'll explain what I mean. Jewish philosophy generally is the attempt to prove things. Let me prove to you that God exists. Let me prove to you that the Torah was given at Sinai. Let me prove to you that the Messiah is correct. Let me prove to you, let me prove to you, let me prove to you. And the big problem with that is that nothing can be proven. What I mean by that is, proof, there's a difference between what's objectively proof and what people are going to be convinced by. I think the real reason most people can't be convinced of anything is that we believe what we see and not what we don't see. And that's true both l'kula and l'chumra. For example, when a magician does a magic trick, you know it's not real. You know, if you're sitting next to a little kid who takes one of these magic tricks out of a cereal box and boom, the nickel disappears. You know, just a guy with a cereal box, why are you impressed? What we see, we assume to be true. What we don't see, we assume to not exist. That's why it's so important for us to learn the lesson from being proven of the existence of things we don't see. It's so important for us to learn the lesson of radio, television, cell phones, that there are waves out there that we don't see, but they exist. And if you take one step to the left, they suddenly don't exist there, and yourself into the work, because the wave isn't there. It's so important for us to learn from the things we don't see but know exist, that there may be many, many more things we don't see and they exist. But the bottom line is, I could bring you proofs from here to tomorrow that God exists. It can make all the sense in the world to you that God exists and that there's no way he doesn't exist. But the bottom line is, until you've seen him, it's hard to believe in him. And that's ultimately the difficulty that we face. Qohelet goes in the opposite direction. His goal is not to prove to you that Judaism exists, or that God exists, or that the Torah was given. Qohelet challenges you to consider the alternative. His goal is to get you to evaluate what life is worth, assuming nothing. See, the real issue is that we choose to live our lives otherwise, or we're torn, pulled towards living our life otherwise, without asking ourselves what the otherwise leads to. And Qohelet wants you to get to, you know, to assess in a sober way what your life amounts to if you don't believe in God and Judaism. And his point is to get you to be honest, to see far ahead. It's a sefer written for young people. To get you to see far ahead, to predict what your life will amount to if you don't believe in this. And then his challenge to you is, now that you see how useless life is, if you don't live it this way, now try and see what basis there is for living it the right way. And I would say this, let's say you could get to, and it's hard to quantify the numbers, 90% proof that God exists and that Judaism is right. So if the alternative is a reality, so maybe the alternative pays. But if the alternative is absolutely no hope, so even if you have a 50 or 60% basis for believing in God, it pays to invest in that direction. And that's why Qohelet is refreshingly different. But it's very hard to learn Sefer Qohelet. And the reason why is because the book is written as an absolute apikoros. Which is why the Gemara on Shabbos says there were people who wanted to hide Sefer Qohelet. It's filter itself. There are psukim here that are against what we believe. And the reason why is, in order to honestly, correctly address the issues of the possible meanings of life, you have to take off your kippah and ask honest, brutal questions. And these are the questions that maybe some of you have asked or wanted to ask inside, but have not been able to ask outside because you're not allowed to ask it. Kohelet's going to be a bigger apikoros than you, which is very useful sometimes, right? That's why I tell people, you come to learn Kohelet, you got to take a kippah off. You got to ask it honestly and openly, because if you don't, you're never addressing the questions honestly and openly, and you still play the game, and inside bubbles the question of whether there's an alternative. So that's an introduction to Kohelet. The first part of what I call Hashkafa 101, I'm happy to talk about what the second part of the shiur is, but maybe not in this introductory thing, we'll talk about it in the coming where I usually go from Kohelet. But Kohelet is where you begin. Before we can talk about any of Jewish beliefs, the question is whether it's worth having any beliefs. Any questions before we begin? Let's begin. Did we Kohelet bend the middle of Yerushalayim? What's the first pasuk? Is this where Kohelet begins, yes or no?
No.
No, you figure from the question it can't be, right? Well, obviously it begins in the beginning, but where else does it begin? Three, I have your Tanakh. Get back to the afterwards if you don't mind. I was asking back to you, I didn't see you in the beginning, so I used it. Where else does Kohelet begin besides the first pasuk? This is a pretty simple question, no? Pasuk Yudbet, no? Look at Pasuk Yudbet. Isn't that an introduction to the Sefer? Ani Kohelet, Hayiti Melech Al Yisrael B'Yerushalayim, no? If you didn't have the first 11 pasukim, and it started with that, nobody would have batted an eyelash, right? Why does Kohelet start twice? By the way, the introductions are very similar. If we want to understand why it starts twice, what we would want to look for is the difference between the second time and the first time. So anyone? By the way, how do we know that Kohelet was Shlomo? Ben David, he had a lot of sons. Melech B'Yerushalayim, that kind of narrows it down. But in any case, we'll have to ask in a second why he uses the name Kohelet. What? That's why I said narrows it down. I don't think Avshalom ruled long enough to be able to write this kind of book. But in any case, getting back to the point, what are the differences between the introductions? First person, you, the second one's in first person. What else? First one is descriptive, the second one is in retrospect. I was king. Meaning, Kohelet is being written by Shlomo at the end of his life. Chazal say Shlomo wrote three books. Anyone knows the other two?
Mishlei
and Shir HaShirim. They say he wrote Shir HaShirim as a young, I would put in the word romantic. Mishlei as an older, sophisticated adult. Kohelet wrote as an old man, I put in the word grumpy old man. What Kohelet is saying is, let me tell you what my life amounted to. Let me tell you the lessons I learned, and maybe you'll learn them before it's too late for you to correct yourself. In fact, as we'll see, not only did he write this in retrospect, but he claims that he lived his life intending to be a guinea pig, so that he could tell people which way to go. So, Yudbet Nun is when he's speaking in first person, and frankly, the bulk of the Sefer is a continuation of that introduction. In the very end of the Sefer, we come back to the beginning with a conclusion that sounds like the introduction. If you want, you can skip ahead to Perek Yudbez, Pasuk Chet. Perek Yudbet, Pasuk Chet. Havel Havelim Amar HaKohelet. He's being described in third person. HaKol Havel. That Pasuk should remind you of the second Pasuk in the beginning of the book. And the book begins with Havel Havelim Amar Kohelet. Havel Havelim HaKol Havel. The conclusion comes back in third person again. Havel Havelim Amar Kohelet HaKol Havel. Continuing in Pasuk Yud, it's also in third person. Bikesh Kohelet. Meaning, you have the book that Shlomo HaMelech wrote. He expressed himself in first person. Ani Kohelet Hayiti Melech. Then we have a section at the beginning and the end that describes him in third person. So either he wrote it in third person, or later people, which is not apikosis in Nevi'im, Chazal says Chizkiyo HaMelech and his Bez Din added on pieces to Sfarim. They wrote an introduction and a conclusion to the Sefer. Whether it was written later or not is totally irrelevant. The point I'm trying to make is that the first section and the last section are descriptive as opposed to personally expressive. And I think the role that the first 11 psukim play is kind of the role that the thesis introduction plays in a thesis paper. How many of you had to write a thesis in high school? Interesting to see. I mean, Skokie Shiva doesn't have a thesis, right? But I assume Ramaz, you had to write a thesis, no? Yes? What's your thesis on?
Joining the defense report.
Ouch. You know from the amount of time a person pauses before giving the answer, the level of sophistication the answer is about to have. So when you hear that long of a pause, you go, oh, no way I'm going to understand this. Okay. Anyone who wants to get deeper understanding of what Yossi is talking about, you can talk to him after. I assume you'll be willing to fill us in, right? I'm surprised you. I'm happy to see you. You see how the thesis also, right? Moshe, what was your thesis on?
Having the right one.
Oh, you did Mishma instead.
Teacher got fired first. Upstairs.
Yeah, okay. In any case, the way a thesis is supposed to be written is that you begin by presenting your conclusion, and then you spend the thesis proving it. The first 11 psukim is where Kohelet tells you his, basically what he's going to say. Well, we're told what he's going to say. Let's read it together. Divrei Kohelet ben David melech Hashem. I have to warn you, the thesis is going to anger you, because he's going to say things that not only are you going to disagree with, but it's going to bother you that he believes otherwise, because it undermines the whole meaning of life and what we're used to assuming our life means. But we have to give him a chance to prove it, right? That's the rest of the book. Before we go on, why did we go under the name Kohelet? Why did we go under the name Shlomo? Well, obviously, well, methodologically, what would the answer be?
What?
He's trying to hide himself. Well, saying Ben David Melech Mishalayim, so what other explanation could we give?
Pseudonym?
Why does the person have a pseudonym? Why did he come here? Methodologically. Which means, without having the exact answer, what would the answer need to be? Assumingly, this name, continue Morty, this name is reflective of the aspect of himself that is expressed in this book. Now we can talk about why and how. But I'm saying the answer would need to be he's using a special name for this book because somehow this name fits this book. The word kahal means what?
Congregation.
Well, it can be used as a verb, lahakil. It means gather, to bring together. Hakel is when we bring together all the people. And the reason the word Kohelet is used is because Kohelet brings together the different possible views on what the meaning of life is. Now, what's important for us to realize is, he's not a shoot in the Kubetzes. This one says, and this one says, and this one says. These are things he himself experienced. He himself lived in a way he's giving his own personal testimony of it. What's his thesis? What's his conclusion? Pasuk Beis. Havel Havelim Amar Kohelet, Havel Havelim HaKol Havel. If you had to use one word, what would the word be? It's five of the eight words in this Pasuk. Havel. A sixth of the eighth is HaKol, which is similar to the word Havel, just a slight thing. And basically his point is, everything amounts to nothing. If you look at it carefully, you can see it through, and you're not fooled by the lies we tell ourselves to be convinced of our own value and the value of what we do. If you can look at it for what it really is, you'll see that it leads to nothing. Why? Pasuk Gimel. Ma yitroen la'adam b'chol amalo she'yamo tachat ha'shamesh. What does the word yitroen mean? What remains? What's left? What does a person have left from everything that he does? Now again, we try to convince ourselves of the value of what we think, what we try to believe is the yitroen. The goal of Sefer Kohelet is to get you to see a few steps down the line and realize that in the end, you get nothing from it. Now, Kohelet isn't going the simple route of the following sentence, but the following sentence definitely is part of his point, as we'll see. A person is born with nothing, and a person takes nothing with them. So ultimately, what has everything in between accomplished? That's not the only point he's making. It's not just the simple death undermines everything argument. There's a lot more in between. And he wants to show you how there's so much in life that can help you see how insignificant what you assume to be significant really is. But ultimately, death is a great way of seeing how insignificant everything is. When I was an ancient Israel, I used to have a chance to ancient Israel, before Sruvi was born, there was a time. I ran in together with Yossi Kamenetsky, we used to play Crimson together, for those who know who that is. Shimi Kamenetsky's younger brother was the chapter advisor of Beth Aaron and Tunek. So one of the popular songs in Bnei Akiva was and says, well, I don't know if it's probably Bnei Akiva, but you can ask them. What is it? Pasuk in Tehillim, Perek Nun. Al tira ki yashirish b'yirda kvod beito. Don't be afraid that you see a person getting rich and you see a person with a lot of kavod. Ki lo b'moto yikach hakol lo yemen acharav kvodo. And he definitely hasn't taken it with him. Perry Tershma was one of the chapter leaders, one of the region leaders out there. Yeah. Shiri Kanev, he was a roommate. I don't know if he told you. Anyway, so the point is, we need to use death and life itself as a way of helping us properly evaluate the significance of what we accomplish in this world. The reason everything amounts to nothing is because in the end there's nothing left. Now we begin something interesting with an expert, Sukkim Dalet Hei Vav Zayin. He speaks about four cycles that are roughly similar to the four types of matter: solid, liquid, gas, energy,
plasma.
Yeah. There you go. Number one, perfect out. Dor helech v'dor ba, v'ha'aretz le'olam omadet. Generations come, generations go, and the world continues forever. It's very depressing when alumni of Yeshiva Takoto come back to Yeshiva. Even when they come back, Shanabet, one of the brothers told me this week, last year, if I didn't know someone, I knew he was Israeli. Now, he could be a Shana Aleph footstep. It's a weird feeling for me. In my own Yeshiva. I call him, imagine when you're an alumni, you come back to Yeshiva. Maybe 7 years after Yeshiva. When you're Shana Gimel, Shana Dalet, for a year or two, so you're a year or two younger than you, you have the Israeli for a Shir Dalet, hey, let's say you come back, you've been at Yeshiva for 8 years. There's one guy in the call, you know. Right? Or, you know, the Rebbeim. All these guys, not only are they here, but they think it's their yeshiva. And they think you're the outsider. When you're in a place, you want to believe that you matter. You are that place. Anybody ever go back to your elementary school to visit? When you were in eighth grade, you were the head, the student body, the board, blah, 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 right? Once you leave, something else takes over. And everything you instituted while you were there, they change. All the big policy changes you made to change the school forever, blah, blah, blah. What's interesting is that in Israeli high schools, and I started this in Yeshiva, they had each year, they put up on the wall not only a picture of the group that was there, but they put up, you know, the picture has each one's individual picture with their name on it. That's a desperate attempt for people to still feel that they're there and they matter. 10, 15 years later, when people look at those pictures, who is that? They're irrelevant. Last year, the bulk of you were seniors. Last year in your high school, right? And you were running the school, and you mattered, and you pushed people around. When you go back, you become irrelevant. We try to convince ourselves that we matter. And we make a big difference. But generations come, generations go, billions, trillions of people have thought that they mattered. And they've been forgotten. It's depressing. Now, people like to believe that they're irreplaceable. You're going to get to a job in this world where you're going to feel you make a big difference. Winston Churchill, everyone knows his famous line? Winston Churchill said, the cemetery is full of people who thought they were irreplaceable. And the truth is, no one's replaceable, but everyone's replaced. That's how the world works. And the things people sweat for and try and invest and make a difference, tomorrow they are crushed, broken, and rebuilt in a new form. The world just has to wait long enough for the sentimental value to be forgotten, and then they'll destroy the shul in Lviv. In Poland right now, there's a shul that's a pro. It used to be the representative image of European Jewry. It was from 1592. And the Ukrainian government plans to break it down and build a hotel. And you know what? They probably will, because there aren't many Jews left there anymore. And the people who built that shul and the money they collected and etc. You travel around the East End of London, or the East Side of New York, or anywhere in the world. And you'll see shuls that people built with blood, sweat, and tears. And now there's social halls and churches. That's where the world works. That's depressing. Nobody wants to know that. Nobody wants that thrown in their face. People want to feel that what they're building is forever. That's why I have a Maimon Chazal about how all the shuls will one day make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. Makes everyone feel better, right? But how much of life is really that way? People invest, they spend their hard-earned money, their hard-earned energy to build things which they assume matter in the long term. But we have to be sober and honest about it. Next, Pasuk 8. V'zarach ha-shemesh, v'va ha-shemesh, v'el mikomo sho'ev zoreach u'sham. First of all, what verb in Pasuk 8 links this second cycle, the cycle of the sun, as opposed to the cycle of generations, to the Pasuk that came before? What verb? Ba. So you have the two ba's here. Measure says that when Adam Rishon was created on Friday, he sinned on Friday. It didn't take him a lot of time. Right? He sinned on Friday. And what happened right after he sinned? The sunset. It was his first sunset. Adam Rishon thought God was turning out the lights, the world's coming. He davened all night, he said to him, and he was terrified. In the morning, what happened? He figured God gave him another chance. He said, Mashiach, Yom HaShabbos, he was so happy. I had a similar story in my own life. A long time ago, I worked in the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union was the Soviet Union. I was there for the Gulf War. Gulf War broke out on Friday night. I don't think any of you were born yet, right? Gulf War broke out on Friday night. Came into shul on Shabbos day. Gabbai gets up, he says, I heard on the radio. He said, means that Tel Aviv was bombed, hundreds of people are dead. It's a Yom Tzar. I spent the whole day saying to him, crying, it was terrible. That night, I got real news. I found out that nobody was killed. Look how powerful my tefillah was. It went from 500 people to zero. So Adam Rishon woke up, the sun rose. How much you think he panicked Saturday night when the sun set? Ah, you mean it does that? Ah, sunset, sunrise. Ah. My point is, if you reflect on it, the sun is rising. It's like optimism, sun rising, higher, higher, higher. Sun's coming out, it's so bright. Why are we not optimistic when the sun rises? Because we know that every step it takes towards rising is really a step towards. So you don't get super excited that the sun is up. Oh, wow, look, the sun's out. Because we know it's going to go down. And the really broader question as an image is, what is it all for? Why go through the whole motion if nothing is accomplished anyway? It's all a cycle. How many of you ever heard of Harry Chapin? Well, I'm impressed that there's at least a few people. Harry Chapin was a really sensitive songwriter. Died some really beautiful songs. I don't know if you know the songs beyond his name. It's a really beautiful Taxi, the Cats in the Cradle, written by him. Cats in the Cradle. What? Mr. Tanner, sure. There's the one about, and I can't be with you. There's a better place to be. It was a film. A very powerful song. Has a funny song called 30,000 30,000 pounds of mashed bananas. It's a song about a truck that went out of control on a hill in Scranton. So I drove by Scranton that night and there again. I'm like, 30,000 pounds, where's Harry? And I was singing it the whole way through, 30,000 pounds, and then I got back. But briefly in Scranton, I was thinking of Harry Chapin. So here's a song called All of Life's a Cycle. Sunrise and Sundown. It's really going on. It's not just the sun rises and sets. Our lives themselves are cycles. Now we take the points we are on the curve very seriously. But we lose the lesson of the context of where we're coming from and where we're going to. So where we are is just for the moment. Like the sunrise, we're moving somewhere else. As we sit, brain cells are dying. We forget that message, right? Of course, that's Pirkei Avos, right? Da me'ayin basa, v'lana t'holech. See your life in context and in perspective so you don't take the moment that you're experiencing out of context. Next. Pasuk Vav, what cycle are you talking about here? It's a little confusing because he doesn't begin with a subject. It's something that goes round and round. Kind of like Joe and Jet. Anyone know Joe and Jet? Yeah? Anyone know any songs by Joe and Jet? I love rock and roll. That's our song. I think it was Joe and Jet. I might be mistaken. You spin me right round. You spin me right round like a record player. No? Right? Joe and Jet, right?
They remade that song with
Andrew. He's been around. Scott, you can feel I'm not alone. Now we're going to play Sapeski. Who is it? When was it? How was it? When was it? Okay. What are we talking about, Puppet Bob? No? Wind. Olech, Oberon, Mesovev, Otsavon, Sovev, Sovev, Olech. Haruach. If you're sitting, again, Kohelet actually sat and reflected. You see the wind blow a piece of paper this way. Then the wind comes and blows it back. The question, what's that all for? What was accomplished? What was the net result? Nothing. That's what I always hated when, about the Messiah Rabin, I watched the baseball game. I say I'm on the Messiah Rabin, not because it's us to watch sports, but it's us to watch baseball because it's stupid and boring and a waste of time. The baseball's like Mamish Mitzvah. You sit there, the guy walks around the mound, he throws a pitch. Just talk about Narishkeit.
It's all about the throws.
What?
It's a thinking game.
Baseball for thinking it. There's a lot of time for thinking. That's what they say. It's an excuse,
Cricket's more boring.
They said it, after the baseball strike a number of years ago, they said people were rebelling and, not going to baseball anymore. And they said, no, they just had the strike. They said, why do we care about this game? It's like a game that goes nowhere. In football, these people get hit every play. People, there's action. It appeals to the man gene. Baseball, just, strange beards. I'm thinking Brian Wilson. What's the deal with that? That's why people in the Midwest and the South went to baseball. What are they supposed to do? They say St. Louis, the Memphis, Atlanta, they're doing Chicago, they're trying to just hope to come home one day. It's pathetic. Anyway, getting back to the point. So I was a baseball game, they said the winds are swirling. If the wind's going out to left field, okay, hits, you know, in the left field. So they're after me. The guy hits the ball in left field. You got to play him deep. What's up, swirling winds? What do the swirling winds do? It's just the papers go around there. Wrigley Field, a lot of times, swirling winds. If I remember correctly, swirling winds. Where do the papers go? What's accomplished by all those winds, by all that energy? Then he's using it as a symbol, as representative of the futility of it all. Pazglein. Kol ha-nichalim holachim al hayam. Ve-hayam einenu malay. Al-makom sha-nichalim holachim sham hem shavim lalechet. What verbs connect this pasuk to the pasuk before? The second two cycles? Yes, you have the holachim and the shav. Shav is also a two-letter verb that has the letter bays in it, like the verb ba. The difference is that shav has a much sharper sense of return to where you began. All the effort just returns you to the original place. And the fourth cycle he chooses is the most frustrating in that it's never full. The rivers keep flowing into the seas, but the seas are never full. And the significance of this imagery is what man ultimately seeks is to be complete, is to finish, is to fill it, is to get one's foot filled, but that's what's most elusive for men. That's what you see in Pasuk Chet. Kol hadvarim yigeim. Things are tiring. Now, it doesn't say me'ayfim. The difference between yageya and ayef, we say by Amalek, that the Jews were ayef v'yageya. The proper translation of the word yageya is weary. I want to talk about for a moment what makes you weary. Let's say you're building a sukkah. Okay? Let's say after building the sukkah, you're just about complete and the whole thing falls apart. The whole thing collapses all at once. What do you suddenly feel at that point?
Weariness.
Thank you, yeah. I don't explain because no one knows what the word means. Meaning, when you're working towards something and you have a sense that you're getting somewhere, that it's for something, there's a different feeling than when you work and work and work and you feel you've gotten nowhere. Why is it so wearying? Because lo yuchal ish v'daber, lo tisba ayin lirot, the eye is never satisfied, the lo ti malay, here's the malay image, ozen mishmoa, the ear is never full. No matter how much you hear, there's more to hear. No matter how much you see, there's more to see. It's never full. There are some people who have this neurosis that requires them to make sure that they have all music on their iPod. There's something they're missing from their iPod, I gotta get it! Right? Whether, you know, the kosher way is non-koreata, I don't have it! Now that a person has on there, I used to have a thing when I was a kid called Desert Island Disc, which is if you had to be on a desert island, which disc would you want to have with you? Which is your favorite desert island disc? So, if this person was stranded on a desert with their iPod, assuming they had enough batteries, they would not have enough lifespan to hear all the songs on their iPod, even if they have nothing else to do. But they gotta hear more. That's what it says in the bottom. How many days and years you can go with this iPod? It's there. It says the 3,267,432 songs equal to 3,370 years. Kind of more. People have this need to feel they have everything. But the truth is, when you realize it, there's no such thing as everything. And we're never satisfied, which is a deeper subjective problem, because objectively the fact that we can't have everything is one thing. But subjectively the fact that we're programmed to feel like no matter how much we have, we don't have enough, makes life even harder to live, because no matter how much we have, it's not enough. I remember when MTV came out, the first thing you have to realize is that MTV did come out. It wasn't like, you know, pre-existent in the world. I remember the 80s when it came out. I remember the first MTV Awards, I mean, you know, it was pretty kiddish. But in any case, its slogan in the beginning, I don't know if it's still the slogan, was, too much is never, never, never enough. They were trying to convince people that they could and should listen to music videos 24 hours a day. But they managed to get a lot of people addicted. But really what says this for me is one of the most famous songs in the history of rock and roll. And again, songs express people's emotions. You know, by the Hail of the Stones. Which song am I talking about? What?
Well, the one
that it speaks to me, and I'm happy to hear if you have any of yourselves, but the one that for me is, they had a song called One Word, Satisfaction. I can't get no... It's classic rock, right? That is faction. And the point of that is the frustration that's being expressed is the one thing that people seek more than anything else is to feel satisfied, to be happy. What does it say about our condition that no matter how much we have experience, we're not satisfied? The world traveler still has more places he needs to travel. The fill in the blank of rich pleasure still feels there's more things he hasn't experienced. And that's terrible because it means we can never be satiated. You know, I think people who are poor, to a certain extent, can be happier than people who are rich because they can always dream about when they have more, then they'll get X, Y, and Z, and they work to have more. The most frustrated people are the people who can have it all because they have it all and they're still not happy. You see the pathetic lives of people like Michael Jackson or, you know, other people of the like. What do you do when you're the greatest singer who ever lived, you're the greatest dancer who ever lived, those are the capabilities you have, you have more money than you know what to do with, you've bought houses every place you can imagine. The guy wasn't happy in his own skin. Well, maybe if I'm white, people will like me. Maybe if I look like a woman, people will like me. Maybe, you know, you just, it's rough mothers, you know what I mean? It's not by coincidence that the people who have penthouses are the ones who jump out of them. Yeah. You know, poor guy doesn't make his life, jumps out the window, he doesn't land very far, you know what I'm saying? What is he going to do? Because you look, when you're poor, you say, well, I'll get a better job in a week, and I have a little more money, I'll be able to go out to eat once a week. I'll have more money, I'll be able to marry a woman who, you know, who's pretty. I'm going to get a little more money, you know, for a little while, do a car. I'll be able to take vacations. I'll be able to be a big guy at work. What happens when you have all that? And you're not satisfied. That's when people go out of their skin. It's interesting that, you know, people in America need therapists and people in China don't. How do people in China survive without all the therapists?
They don't know
any therapists. That's what we say, right? That's what, I mean, yeah, that's, and you know what? Adam said, I'm sure there are a lot of people in China who need therapists. But I'm sure that the percentage, if we had some objective way of figuring out if people need a therapist, whatever that means, I'm sure the objective rate of need for therapists in China is lower than it is in America. Just as it was lower 50 years ago in America when people had less. Now, I'm not against the field of psychology and developing an understanding of people's needs. I am saying, though, that as people have more, it's more frustrating when they're not happy. I'm saying if the Jewish immigrants who came over on the boat, I think, were often more happy than their kids who have everything that they worked for. And that's really sad. Because if you know you don't have everything, you work for it. When you have everything, well, what does it mean now that you have everything? Baruch Hashem, I don't have everything. So, you know, I still have a lot to work towards and have everything in the right things. So I don't know what it's like, but I read the stories. You know, Michael Jackson is just an example. They don't seem very happy, the people with everything. Let's continue. Let's finish off. Let's go back to Seder. Pasuk Tes. Ma shehaya hu sheyiyeh, ma sheyiyeh na'asa hu sheyiyaseh, v'hein kol chadash tachat ha'shamash. This is a statement that we can't possibly agree with until he's going to prove it to us more at length. Let me just explain it. What was is what will be. What was done is what will be done, and there's nothing really new. Interestingly, under the sun is again represented of that cyclical nature. Meaning, we think we're discovering new things. We think we're experiencing new phenomena. But the truth is, they're really there already. Now, the obvious kasha is, what are you talking about? So many inventions. Right? So people invent things all the time. His response to this is Pasuk Yud. Yesh davar sheyomar le'eze chadashu. There are things that people will say, look, this is new, but in truth, כבר היה לעולמים אשר היה מלפנינו. It already existed before. If you look carefully at the innovations of society, you can see how people who claim to have innovated were less innovative than they really were. They're really building off something that came before them, which built off something that came before them, and so on and so forth. The people who convince society that they are the innovators are the people who do a good job of selling the little bit they added to what came before them. Now, of course, we want to feel like we innovate. but no one invents the wheel. The computer is based upon, we can go back to step by step, to the smaller things that existed before that people convinced others that they created on their own. Right? The famous story about the fact that Columbus did not discover America, right? Neither did Amerigo Vespucci. And I'm not even talking about the Indians, I'm thinking about that, right? Meaning, even if you're talking about new men, there were people who had discovered X before, but it was a matter of who did a better job selling the fact that they discovered America. And the point is, when you come to realize that each generation, each innovator, is going to present themselves as having innovated, which you need to do by playing down what those before you did, what you realize is that just like our generation today needs to believe in its own value and significance, and does that by playing down the accomplishments of earlier generations, what we need to realize is the same thing we do to the generations before us is the same thing that the next generation is going to do to us. You know, there are a lot of rabbis, they don't quote achronim. So they're telling me to learn not to quote achronim, including their rebbe. The point is the extent to which we understand that we're really just building one little piece upon what came before us. We're not as significant as we want to convince ourselves we are. And with this reflection, he ends this first part of the thesis. The first part. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Ein zichron l'rishonim. There's no memory of the earlier generations. V'gam l'achronim sheyu lo yiyah lahem zikaron im sheyu l'achrona. No matter how late you are, in the end you'll be forgotten. And we talk about wanting our life to be significant, that will make a difference and be remembered. How many people inhabited the world 4,000 years ago? How many of them are remembered? The chances of a person being remembered are minuscule. And really what he ends with here is just a little spin of what he began with. If we go back to Pasuk Gimel, well, how did he prove that nothing's worth anything? Pasuk Gimel, Ma Yitron La'adam. Because what does a person have to show for it? What's left in the end? There are two ways a person can base their belief in the significance of their lives. A, I took something from it. Look what I had to show for it. And number two, I'm remembered. Not what I take from it, but look at the difference of it. Look how I'm remembered. Kohelet begins his thesis by claiming that there is no Yitron, Ma Yitron, Adam Cholam Alam. And he concludes by saying, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ein Zichron, very similar word, Rishonim Vegam Lachronim. We didn't even begin to learn the book, but what we were introduced to here is the point he's trying to make, which is, let's evaluate the true significance of the lives we live. And let's evaluate it without the lies we tell ourselves to convince ourselves that our lives are worthwhile. Let's evaluate what we really take from it and what difference we really make. And how do you do any of this? You just put it on the table. Next week we'll begin Kohelet's actual analysis through his reflection. And the general information will be even the first week's 5 to 10 minutes. And then we'll have Shefa 4:15, we end on time. We'll drag out a little bit this week. I'll go also a little slower. I just want to get something on the table this week. We'll see some of these ideas more than once. Every third week or so, depending on people's request, we'll use this slot for questions and answers or special topics or both. There's a time where, you know, to give sichot to people about the things that we want everyone to hear. Any questions about this or anything else? Okay, I want you to have a continued good day.